Welcome to this podcast called Curious About Recovery. I am Kirsten Honeyball. I am your host. And in this podcast, I'll be diving deep into eating disorders, which are complex and challenging to navigate. So whether you're a sufferer, a professional, a family or loved one of a sufferer, you can join me as I get curious by interviewing professionals, chatting to eating disorder survivors, and sharing my personal experience with an eating disorder so that you can better understand various perspectives, remove stigma, hear inspiring testimonies, and simply get curious about all things eating disorder related. I would like to put out a trigger warning. These episodes explore the topic of eating disorders, and some content may be triggering to listeners. Topics explored may mention, but are not limited to, trauma, diets, food and body types, suicide, mental illness, substance use, self-harm, violence, gender identification topics, and more. Please take care before listening to any episodes. It's important to note that this podcast is not aimed to diagnose, treat, or cure any form of mental illness and should not be seen as a replacement for treatment of eating disorders. Everything said here is expressed in relation to personal and professional opinions, and listeners should be encouraged to view these episodes as an open-minded exploration of various possibilities and perspective rather than hard facts and solutions. Please take what applies or resonates with you and leave the rest. And if you're struggling with an eating disorder, don't hesitate to reach out to me at kirsten@kirstenhoneyball.co.za. Welcome to today's podcast episode. Today we have Joy Zelikowski with us. She is a clinical psychologist who specializes in eating disorders and disordered eating. She helps people learn how to manage feelings of being out of control or in pain and distress in healthy ways by helping them reclaim their lives and create and develop better relationships to their food, body, exercise, and substances. She applies health at every size and intuitive eating philosophies to the work she does and how she helps people, and runs her own practice called Nourish the Heart Counseling. Thank you so much for being on the show. How are you doing today?
I am good. And thank you so much for having me. I love talking about eating disorders and educating people.
Yeah, it's such a passion. And I just thought it was so needed in the world. I mean, to just break the stigma and to just get it out there. So really, really helps me that there's people as passionate about it as I am. So just diving straight into it, I'd love to know a little bit more about the work you do and why you do the work you do, what motivated you to move into this niche area, and yeah.
So ironically enough, in high school, I had a number of friends with eating disorders. And when you're the friend of someone with an eating disorder, or a family member, it's usually a pretty miserable experience. You're watching your friend and her family in a lot of pain. There's usually a lot of tension, arguing. You don't really understand what was going on. At least I didn't as an adolescent. And when I started to move more into psychology, I thought, I will never work with eating disorders. This is not something I wanted to do. And I finished my degree and I'm looking for jobs. And there was nothing out there other than at a residential eating disorder facility. And I thought, okay, you know, I'm just going to do this for a little while I get my master's degree. I don't have to do it forever. It'll be good experience. And like day one, I loved it. And I was like, I don't want to do anything else. And it's actually very different when you're not personally connected to the person who's struggling with an eating disorder. And there are not enough practitioners. It's astounding to me that this is still the number one cause of death of adolescent young women, and the second most deadly disease of all mental health disorders, surpassed only by opioid abuse. And we still don't have people who are qualified and knowledgeable to even refer, let alone actually treat the disorder. So that's how I got interested. It was sort of just by chance. It was something that I was like, I'll never do this. And then I was like, oh, I don't want to do anything else, actually.
It's such a crazy thing to think about. You know, when you think about opioid addiction and how damaging that can be to a person and how a lot of people end up dying from that, you would think that something that is pretty much on a par with the death or mortality rate would be as equally researched, as equally funded, as equally knowledge, as equally known about and supported by medical facilities, by institutes and all of that stuff. And just to say that there is this incredible lack of people who actually know how to help. And it makes me think, you know, my grandmother had bulimia when she was my age, and they didn't know that there was such a thing as bulimia. It wasn't like, it didn't make any sense, you know?
Well, and the most concerning part is that the opioids have always been a problem. That's not new. But the opioid crisis or epidemic is newer over the past several years. Up until that point, eating disorders were the number one killer of all mental health diagnoses. And then they were surpassed by opioids. And now they've stayed at number two, with opioids being number one. So this is not a new development that eating disorders are deadly. They have been deadly this entire time with lack of funding, resources, and education. And then the opioid crisis, which is a very serious crisis, happened. And all this money and funding and education and resources have gone to that. And still, this other incredibly disease is not getting the support and resources that it really needs to help people.
I mean, you might not necessarily have an answer to this, and it probably puts you on the spot a bit, but why do you think that is? Like, what are we missing?
Oh, there's so much. That's such a complicated. I think this is a different answer than I would have given you probably 5 to 10 years ago. To be honest, I think a lot of it has to do with misogyny and patriarchy. Eating disorders are still seen as a woman's disease. And we know that across the board, women's issues get less funding, less consideration, and are often taken less seriously. Now, we know that it's not just a woman's disease. We know that men are impacted. We know that trans folks are impacted. We know that everybody is impacted by eating disorders across the lifespan, all shapes and sizes, all genders, all gender identities, sexual orientations. Everybody can be impacted by disordered eating or eating disorders, but they are still very much seen as an adolescent white woman's disorder. And I do think, I hate to say it, but I do think that impacts the funding and the consideration that has gone into resources, research, and just the willingness that we are to invest in eating disorder research and treatment.
Yeah, I mean, it breaks my heart even thinking about something as with that kind of magnitude and with that kind of depth. I mean, we're not even speaking about the severity of the illness itself, but we're speaking to something so much deeper, which is this idea that women kind of just got to take it, you know, they just, the stigma that's around the fact that it is a young adolescent white woman's disease. And just because of that fact, it's not seen as necessary to give as much attention to as other illnesses. And that, sure, it breaks my heart. But I mean, luckily we've got people like you just really stepping into that place and trying to advocate for it and trying to do something about it and trying to help a person one step at a time, you know. And lovely that you happened upon that treatment facility, that you happened to do this, because when you do start to understand the illness on a much deeper level, especially from a psychological level, you can actually go like, wow, this is really complex. And I don't know if I'm just speaking for myself, but the idea that eating disorders are so complex that as a therapist, you're almost intrigued by them. You know, you're like, wow, this goes so deep. I'm never going to stop learning, you know, so.
And I think that's the other thing. They often get portrayed as this really shallow thing, that it's just girls wanting to be pretty or wanting to be thin. And that's, yeah, the body image distortion is a part of it, certainly, but it is so much more complicated than that. There's stuff going on with your brain that is like compulsively having people act in certain ways and think certain things. There's genetics that are, I mean, it's so complex. It's not just people wanting to look pretty or be thin. And I think that's also part of why it gets dismissed so often, because it's like, oh, those are just, you know, again, like white women trying to be thin. Is that really something we want to invest our time in?
Yeah, I mean, you're speaking to so many layers of issues right here, and I think that, you know, as a psychologist, you definitely help people with an array of issues, and a lot of the time these can co-occur. And so, you know, how do you as a professional approach eating disorders? Because at the beginning you were like, oh, I don't want anything to do with this because it's so complex, and then you found yourself drawn to it. How do you, what modalities do you use? How do you help navigate or help a person navigate their environment internally and externally if they are struggling with an eating disorder?
Yeah, so I view eating disorders as fundamentally maladaptive coping, which means that somebody has something going on in their life and they don't have adaptive coping skills or healthy coping skills to manage whatever it is they have going on. So they have made a genuine effort to help themselves. They're doing the absolute best that they can, but the way that they've ultimately decided to help themselves or figured out to help themselves, long run does not work for them. And there's lots of reasons why people choose these things. So like we know for people who choose restriction or starvation, a lot of times there are processes in the brain that actually give them like a little buzz when they're starving. So it gets reinforced. When people are binging or purging, we also know that there's a dopaminergic release. So again, there's a little buzz when you do that. And again, those things become reinforced. The problem is you have to keep doing them over and over again, and they don't actually address what's going on and the emotions that people are trying to deal with. So people get stuck in these cycles. And so what I do is a lot of like, okay, first of all, let's get you some better coping skills, which is a really hard sell because nothing ever feels as good as what you're doing. Like journaling will never feel as good as restricting. Like that's just a fact. And long-term journaling will serve you much better because you won't be damaging your body. You'll be able to navigate those emotions better. You'll be able to interact in life in a much better way. So that's the sell, right? That long-term, these adaptive coping skills are going to serve you much better. But in the moment when you're like, I could journal or I could restrict, that's a really hard choice because restricting feels so much better. So that's kind of the first layer of like, let's get you some coping skills. And then I also work from a modality called interpersonal process therapy. So it's an integrative therapy. It looks at cognitions, family systems, attachment, really looks at kind of the whole person. And the foundation of it is that something's going on with our relationships. Either we don't have solid relationships, there's some confusion in our roles, or just there's some discord in our relationships, and that if we start to work on our relationships, we start to work on these coping skills and the systems that we're a part of, then we'll start to see more positive results. And one of the fundamental ways that that happens is between the therapist and the client. So if we work on our relationship, and if we have what we call corrective emotional experiences and therapy between the two of us, then those are things that you can start to translate into your life outside of therapy. So that's, in a nutshell, kind of what I do with clients.
What you're speaking about, these maladaptive coping mechanisms, is so resonant for myself as well. I once heard a lady say that the eating disorder, you were attempting to do something that protected you or made you feel love or made you feel safe or anything. But so in your almost ignorance and innocence, you were doing something that you thought was good. And now you come to this idea of now there's this habit cycle, this reward system that's happening, the dopamine, the buzz that you're getting. So, does this play into, do you think, a form of addiction? Because a lot of the time people classify eating disorders as addictions, but I know it's not that cut and dry. It's not that linear. But how do those two things relate, and how do they co-occur or interact with each other?
So funny you should ask, because I used to work in addictions as well. I used to run the eating disorder program in an addiction facility in a rehab. And they're very similar and they're very different at the same time. So, and they're highly co-occurring. The last statistics that I remember were like 30% of people who meet full criteria for a substance abuse disorder were also going to meet criteria for an eating disorder. And about 50% of people who meet full criteria for an eating disorder were going to meet criteria for a substance abuse disorder. So if you think about it from that model of maladaptive coping, that makes sense, right? Because addiction is also a form of maladaptive. The last statistics that I remember were like 30% of people who meet full criteria for a substance abuse disorder were also going to meet criteria for an eating disorder. And about 50% of people who meet full criteria for an eating disorder were going to meet criteria for a substance abuse disorder. So if you think about it from that model of maladaptive coping, that makes sense, right? Because addiction is also a form of maladaptive coping. It's another attempt to help navigate painful and confusing and unwanted emotions. And again, ultimately, it's not a healthy or helpful way of navigating, but it is a way of trying to do that. It's a genuine attempt to help yourself. In fact, we have a number of negative consequences when we stop eating food, which will ultimately lead to our death. So that's one of the fundamental departures of, is this an addiction? Are there similar processes that occur in the brain? Absolutely. But I think the other thing that people forget is that dopamine is a part of everything. Like when we move, we release dopamine because that encourages us to move. When we eat regularly, we have dopamine. When we have sex, when we have a pleasant encounter with a friend, we release dopamine. When we are engaged in addiction, the amount of dopamine that is being released is much more significant. And I will say, I'm not aware of how much dopamine is released when someone restricts or when they binge or purge. So I would have to brush up on the research. I'm not going to pretend to know those numbers. The newest thing that we're seeing, not new, but I think the more poppy thing that we're seeing is food addiction. I will say again, this is my personal experience, and I am not invalidating anybody's experience. This is my opinion based on my research and my experience as a clinician. I do not believe that food addiction is an addiction. In my experience, most of the time when people believe that they are addicted to food, they are also restricting either calories or food groups. And we know that doing either of those is the number one trigger for binging. And so when you put it in that context, I believe that most often what people experience as food addiction is a response to restriction of either calories or food groups. And when the research is coming out, we're also seeing like that dopaminergic response to food, but we're seeing that in response again to people who are restricting calories or food groups. So I think there's a lot of work to be done there. Now, having said that, if somebody feels like they experience food addiction and they feel like that is a major issue for them, I'm certainly not going to tell you that that's not your experience and that's your experience isn't valid. That's not my place to do so. But I would probably then say we need to focus on really looking at intuitive eating and what's lacking in your diet and how to have a healthier relationship with food. And my expectation would be once you do that, you would see the cravings and the pieces that feel like addiction start to go down. So I know that was a lot of response to your question.
Absolutely wonderful. I mean, there's two spaces that I want to move into after that. The first one is this idea of, you know, intuitive eating. I mean, a lot of people speak about this idea of intuitive eating. How do you personally describe intuitive eating and how do you teach it?
So intuitive eating is the relationship that you have with food when kind of you don't have to think about it as much. So when you eat when you're hungry, when you eat just because you want to, I think that's a common misconception that people assume that when you're eating intuitively, you will only eat when you're hungry. Sometimes we eat for lots of different reasons because something looks good. You're at a birthday party and they're serving cake and you're not particularly hungry, but you want a piece of cake. That's fine. That's being intuitive. You're on vacation in Paris and you pass a bakery and you stop for, you know, a cup of coffee and a croissant. You're not really hungry, but that's what you do when you visit Paris, right? Like, that's fine. That's intuitive eating. You know, I see a lot of people who will not keep certain foods in the house because they're like, I can't have those things around because I just go through them in 5 seconds. when you're eating intuitively, you'll have those things when you want them. And then you'll notice they kind of just hang around for a while because there isn't that pressure of, oh my gosh, I don't know when this is going to be around again. I don't know when I'm going to have access to this again. There's this feeling of safety around food that I can have what I want when I want, and I don't have to worry that things are off limits to me. And so how do you teach that? That's hard. It's hard because there's a lot of education that goes into it. There's a lot of confronting these diet culture beliefs that we have, which tell us that there's good foods and there's bad foods, and that we should be eating a certain way. We shouldn't be eating certain things, that we're damaging ourselves if we eat certain things. There's very little evidence to actually support that. Now, of course, if you have an allergy to something, I mean, you can still choose to eat that. You know, there's consequences to that, but you can certainly still eat it. But if you have an allergy, it makes sense to avoid certain things. But if you don't have an allergy, having a wide variety of foods that includes sugars and fats and proteins and starches and all of those things is really normal and really healthy. And we actually need all of those things.
I love the way that you've kind of described this, is this idea that when we relate to food, it doesn't occupy brain space more than is needed, you know. So when it happens, it happens. And when it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen, you know. But I also can relate to, because of lived experience, and also because I've heard this in a lot of the people that I deal with, is this idea of, you mentioned not having something in the house because, you know, I go out of control. And yes, this is probably as a result of either mental or physical restriction of food, or that certain type of food, or certain rules you have around that food. So, you know, I have heard, and maybe you can confirm or tell me if this is incorrect, but I have heard that sometimes an intuitive eating process at the beginning isn't something necessarily that a client can, and or a person who's struggling with eating disorder can grasp or should do, you know, that there should be some kind of structure and then moving into a place of more intuitive based eating. What are your thoughts around this?
Spot on. Intuitive eating is aspirational. It's not necessarily realistic for everybody. Some people will get to a place where they feel like they're kind of like living the intuitive eating dream. Other people will always need a little bit more structure and a little more thought into their food because they're at high risk for relapse. And they just, that's the way they need to eat to be safe, especially in the beginning of treatment. Your hunger and fullness signals and your ability to be interoceptive and your ability to intuitively eat is all over the place. And like a lot of my clients will say, well, I'm not hungry, so if I'm being intuitive, I'm not going to eat. And I'm like, yeah, if you're being intuitive, you're going to die. Like, we can't do that. You know, and they know, they're joking with me when they say those things, but they're aware that their hunger and fullness signals are completely turned off. And so if they're eating intuitively, they're not going to eat because they're never hungry. So in the beginning of treatment, and this is across the range of eating disorder treatment, we're really working on getting you into a healthy relationship with food, which means a healthy schedule, which means you may also need to be a little bit more rigid about when you eat and what you eat at first, with the aspirational goal of getting you to a place where you don't have to think about it anymore. And again, some people will get there. Other people will find a place somewhere in the middle that works for them and keeps them healthy and keeps them from relapsing into their eating disorder that may not look exactly like the full model of intuitive eating, but that's what works for them.
It speaks also to this idea that you can work on the food behaviors, and that's going to look like it's going to look different for every single person. But then at the same time, you're bringing in this other modality of psychotherapy that goes, the relationships that I have, my romantic relationships, my relationships with my colleagues, my parents, my spouse or whatever, is going to affect the way that we relate to ourselves and our bodies. What are the patterns? Do you recognize any patterns that come up in these relational aspects? And how do people start to navigate these and recognize how significant they are in relationship to our food and body?
Yeah. And there's a couple like types when we think about eating disorders. And when I say this, I want people to keep in mind that not everybody is going to fall into this type exactly. If you're struggling with food or an eating disorder and this doesn't represent you, that doesn't mean your experience isn't valid or that you aren't struggling. These are just some of the common things that we notice. We tend to notice among people who restrict that they're very sensitive in their relationships. They're very aware of other people's feelings and actions, and they're often trying to smooth things over and sort of keep peace in relationships and different systems. They tend to be very people-pleasing. They tend to be very perfectionistic, high-achieving. You know, a lot of the clients that I work with, I'm just astounded by the fact that they're full-time students with jobs and like 30 million things, while meantime they're like starving themselves and, you know, a step away from death. And that's part of what's really difficult about treatment, because they're like, well, I'm so successful. Like, what is the problem? This is not impacting me in other ways. Like, why is this an issue? So we often see those types of people. We also see folks who have really turbulent relationships. They struggle to connect with other people. They struggle to feel safe in relationships. Also fairly sensitive, but sometimes a little more volatile and struggling to really find their place. And sometimes people pleasing, sometimes also testing. There's, you know, a variety of relationships that we see. And so really, when we start to work on those relationships and work on what are some healthy boundaries, how do you feel safe in your relationships? How do you get your needs met in healthy ways? Because when you think about the spectrum on both ends, people really aren't getting their needs met. They're trying to, but they're trying to do that by meeting other people's needs first instead of their own, which often means that their needs never get met. And so how do you advocate for yourself in a healthy way? How do you learn to speak up in a healthy way? Which, again, for a lot of women is still very difficult. And for a lot of men, too. Like, how do you experience a wide range of emotions instead of the emotions that men have been told are acceptable, which is sort of like anger and humor and drunkenness? Like, this is the other, like, you can express everything when you're drunk, that's acceptable. But when you're sober, you can really only be like stoic, angry, or funny as a guy. And so how do you learn to engage in relationships and express your emotions in a healthy way? And one of the great ways to do that is to test it out in therapy, you know, and get that immediate feedback of like, well, when I do this, what's that like in the room?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely are just coming out of the, I guess, generation before us, which was so mentally constricted in the ability to go like, you know, this is who I am. This is what I think. This is what I feel. And I'm allowed to express it and it's safe, you know. And this is definitely a very new concept. I mean, the fact that the idea of the self was I think it's only like 60 years old or something like that. You know, like, people were never questioning who they are and how they want to show up. So the importance of showing up authentically in a relationship allows you to also then show up authentically for yourself. Because I think if you're showing up authentically for yourself in relationships, you can then reflect and see the ripples of being able to say, hey, I'm actually allowed to feel this way. I'm actually allowed to process this emotion. I'm actually allowed to say this thing. And it really just is very, very important how relationships externally reflect our internal ones as well. You know, and this is also something, you know, in your bio, you talk about the fact that you also help people move into a better relationship with exercise as well. I've heard a lot of schools of thought where you go into recovery from an eating disorder and it's just like, no, you're not even, I mean, I remember a treatment facility I was at, I wasn't allowed to walk around a soccer field because that was seen as acting out on my behavior, you know, and I understand the mentality behind that. I understand the professionals trying to help me, but, you know, this idea of exercise or bodily movement is actually something that can be really nourishing for you. So how do you help people move into that healthy relationship?
Yeah. And the thought about a complete cutoff from exercise has changed a bit. We do recognize now, well, we always knew exercise was healthy. That was never a secret. But, you know, if you use anything in excess, it can become unhealthy. And so It's again, it's a spectrum. It's really about talking to your client and figuring out what do you need right now. So I have clients who said, I can't exercise right now. I don't feel like I have a good relationship with exercise. And if I start, I can't stop. I can't find that balance. So, okay, no exercise right now. Let's continue to assess and figure out when you think you're ready to try that and what would feel safe and how do we start. And I've had other clients who've said, I know I was over-exercising, but I feel like I've come to a place where I have a healthier relationship with exercise, taking in enough nutrients that I think my body is in a good place. Okay, great. Let's do it. You know, and then there's other clients who kind of fall in between who were like, okay, maybe some walking, some gentle yoga, something where you can move and get your body going a little bit without putting too much stress. You also have to keep in mind that when people are really malnourished and at really low weights, they are at risk for stress fractures and other medical complications from movement. So this should always be ideally, you know, something that a medical professional has input in. And so I try not to be the one making recommendations regarding exercise. Like, we're talking about the relationship to exercise, but it's like, has your dietitian or has your doctor cleared you to move in, you know, an ideal situation? That doesn't always happen. And sometimes then it's more about just, well, how do you feel when you move? Does it feel compulsive? If I called you up and said, get off the treadmill right now, could you do it? Or do you feel like you would have to finish doing whatever you were doing? If you can't stop, to me, that's a sign that there's still some stuff there that we really have to work through with exercise. Does that mean you stop exercising completely? No, you know, but there's some ish we got to work through.
Yeah. And I love the fact that you said it's about that relationship, you know. I mean, I remember at one point I was obsessively walking and I was on the call and I was literally saying to this mentor that I was working with, I was like, I can't stop. And in that moment recognized like how unhealthy it was and how much of a compulsive act it is. And I suppose if you can help someone move into that space where it's like, can you be honest with yourself about the motives, the compulsions, the feelings, the, you know, what is it covering up? Are you doing this because it makes your body feel good? Or are you doing it because you couldn't be honest with your partner today? You know, like, where's it coming from? When speaking about people who are coming for professional help, either with a coach or a therapist or a dietitian or anything like that, there can be a lot of fear in this area, especially for someone that has a mental illness like an eating disorder, where there's a lot of shame, a lot of stigma. So a lot of people will go years before reaching out. Do you have any words of encouragement for those people who aren't sure of how to get help or how they could benefit from it?
Yeah. So I think the biggest thing is we want to help and your experience is valid. Your fear is valid, and we're here to help, not to judge. So I've had clients who've come to me who realize they need help, but they're not ready to change behaviors yet. Okay, you know, that's fine. We can still do some good work. Now, having said that, ultimately, my job is to keep people safe. So if I'm concerned that medically they're unsafe or psychologically they're unsafe, I do need to bring those concerns up and at the very least have a conversation about it, you know, and maybe recommend a higher level of care. But ultimately, I can't force people to do anything that they don't want to do. So a lot of times it's just about, let's just put that out in the room that I'm concerned about you, that I'm worried that you're doing some real damage here, and that I think you need a higher level of care. And how do we work towards getting you to that? And I know some clinicians feel differently about that. They will not work with people who don't follow their recommendations. And there's nothing wrong with that either. I think everybody has a different way of working where they feel safe, where they feel like they're keeping their clients safe. I have found that I've made some really good progress with folks where I haven't forced a higher level of care, that they've been able to get there on their own. But it was dicey sometimes. You know, we had to have a lot of medical intervention. We had to really be on top of things to make sure that person was safe. And sometimes they really weren't. And so that can be really scary, both as a clinician and I'm sure as a client. But ultimately, we want to help you. I think something that also keeps people out of treatment is feeling like they're too large to have an eating disorder. And so I know people can't see me, but I am a fat person. I'm a fat clinician. We talk about that. I do practice from a health at every size model. And I also want people to know that any size body can have an eating disorder. You don't have to be small. You don't have to be in a super sized body. Any size body can struggle with their relationship with food. And just because you don't think your body is the right size to fit a diagnosis doesn't mean you don't deserve help. And that's, I've seen that keep a lot of people out of treatment, that they didn't feel, especially didn't feel small enough to deserve help. And that's just not true. You deserve help because you're struggling, and that's the end of it.
You know, as you're saying this, it speaks so much to this idea that, you know, why do we have issues with our food and our body in the first place is because we don't necessarily recognize that it's actually the thought process that is the sickness. You know, it's not the size that you are. It's not, I mean, yes, in some ways it's the food that you eat or you don't eat or something like that. But at the end of the day, this idea of the illness is in the mind. And the fact that we give so much attention to the physical side of this, especially in the medical world at the moment, we go like, cool, if you haven't ticked this box and you don't qualify, and as soon as you tick that box, sorry, you're out, you can't get any treatment anymore, you know? And I think that can be a very damaging thing. So speaking to that, this being a huge gap in the way that we approach eating disorder treatment at the moment, what else comes up for you? I mean, in your professional experience and the studies you did and the treatment facilities that you worked at, and we won't name any names, but just to think, are there any gaps that you recognized as a professional that might need more attention?
So the eating disorder world, ironically enough, is pretty fat phobic. And that is a challenge for both people in smaller bodies and people in larger bodies. And I will say, I think that's changing. I think a lot of people are starting to address it, are starting to understand how it has impacted treatment and hurt people, and really making positive and good efforts to make change. But it's still there. One of my most hated diagnoses is atypical anorexia. There's nothing atypical about it other than you're in a larger body. And it causes so much harm because people... If people hear atypical anorexia, they hear I'm too fat to have a real eating disorder, which is not true. And they're causing so much harm to their body. It's so frustrating as a clinician because there's no reason for it. We still hear clinicians saying to clients, don't worry, we won't have you gain too much weight in weight restoration. No. No, that's not the point. The point is the person's body is going to settle where it's going to settle. Shira Rose, who is a therapist and also in recovery from an eating disorder, does a really wonderful job talking about her experience and treatment. And she's talked about how she's been given different food recommendations based on her size alone, not her actual nutritional needs. Like the one that always stands out to me is they went on an excursion somewhere and they got ice cream, and everybody else was asked to get two scoops to complete the meal challenge. And she was told she could only have one because she was in a larger body. That is not how eating disorder treatment should work. It is fat phobic. It is reinforcing the eating disorder, and it is not actually treating anybody in a healthy or respectful way. And those things are still happening. You know, I think, again, slowly we're starting to unpack these things. The other thing is that a lot of eating disorder treatment centers and a lot of eating disorder clinicians happen to be in smaller bodies. And I think there's a lot of different reasons for this. I think a lot of people are in recovery from an eating disorder themselves, which sometimes means they're in a smaller body. Sometimes it doesn't. We obviously still live in a very diet culture and fat phobic world, which sometimes forces people to be in a smaller body, and people have their own stuff with food that, and sometimes people just genetically are in a smaller body. So I think there's a lot of things that go into why that happens. But I also think as a person in a larger body or a smaller body where your body image is severely distorted, going into treatment and only being treated by people in smaller bodies it sends a message, right? It sends a message about what health and recovery looks like. We know that representation is important. So when you don't see healthy models of fat people in recovery or having healthy relationships with food, it feels like that's not a possibility. So yeah, that was my very long answer to that.
As I speak to you, as I'm listening to you, I really hear a lot of things that were said to me. Like in the very beginning, I remember a girl who was counseling me at the time. She was also in a smaller body. And when I said to her, you know, I'm scared of the weight gain that's going to come after refeeding on in anorexia. And she said to me, well, look at me. Do I look fat? And I was like, at that time, I said, well, no. And then she was like, well, then that means that you don't have to be either. And I just remember thinking like, whoa, that is just such a non-helpful thing for me to hear, you know. And I remember one of the most peaceful things that I ever like, that ever landed in my head was, if I'm recovered and my body is whatever size that it's going to be, then I'm happy with that. You know, I'm at peace with that. I'm at peace with whatever shows up for me, because I'm recognizing that I'm not my body. We are not our bodies. Yes, our bodies are vehicles. Our bodies are tools. But when we're in a healthy relationship to food, we will settle in the place that our bodies thrive at, you know, and that's just such an important thing to recognize.
It's so important. And it's also important to realize that fat phobia and thin privilege impacts things. Like I talk to clients about that, and like internally, it's like, yeah, like I can accept myself and I can be in a good place about my body. And they'll say to me, but the reality is that being in a thinner body comes with privileges. So I think there's a lot. I think people are dealing with obviously their own internalized things that they've encountered in their culture. You know, sometimes family and loved ones are supportive, but then they're dealing with their own stuff that they've internalized. And so, you know, they make comments or they say certain things, not even realizing sometimes that what they're saying is harmful for that person's recovery. We still live in a world that promotes dieting and restriction until it doesn't. You know, if you're too small, it's a problem. But up until you get to that point, of course you should be trying to actively lose weight. That's healthy till it's not. So it's really hard to have somebody say like you should eat whatever you want when you want and not worry about your size, and the wellness industry has now manipulated this into being less about size and appearance and health. And so it's like, well, if I don't do these things, I'm not going to be healthy. And so clients and folks who are struggling with this are fighting against so many things right off the bat. Even simple things like having to go to the doctor and get weighed, and just all the trauma that can cause for people. And when people are not eating disorder informed, and how nursing staff and doctors handle that situation can be so incredibly hard for clients who are trying to recover. And so it feels like there's so many stumbling blocks for people. The other thing is we just don't have enough clinicians. We don't have enough eating disorder clinicians. We don't have enough dietitians who are eating disorder informed. Try finding a medical provider who does eating disorders. I mean, it's like you just got to hope most of the time that you find somebody who's at least willing to listen. In Connecticut, we are very lucky. We have two adolescent providers who are eating disorder specialists who are amazing. And then there's a handful of other adolescent providers who've trained under them or have had some training and are just fantastic. But it's few and far between, and it's almost impossible to find someone for adults. So it's really challenging to actually get a solid team together for someone to get the most appropriate level of care. The other thing we're noticing too is that really, in-home services are key to helping people recover. They do all this great work in residential and then IOP, PHP. They get home and they lose all that structure and all that extra support. And it sort of all starts to fall apart. And so we're seeing some really wonderful services like meal coaching and eating disorder coaches step into the picture. But they're very cost prohibitive. They're most often not covered by insurance. which requires people to private pay or find scholarships or find people who do sliding scale to access some of these really fundamental sources to help keep them in recovery and successful. So I actually don't even remember what your original question was, but these are some of the challenges I think I see to recovery.
Well, I mean, it's definitely, you've answered a lot of questions that I had in mind at the same time. And, you know, I definitely see, I mean, I also experienced that. I came out of treatment and just slapped back into the place that I was. And no one that I was around or living with or anything like that was informed. No one knew what to do. No one knew what the signs were or what, you know, so this idea of, and I suppose that speaks to another gap in the medical world is like, when will we start seeing these as critical elements of the recovery process? And you kind of got to go one step back and like say, well, you can't see this as a critical element of the recovery process if you haven't seen the recovery process as critical in the first place. You know, after looking at your website, I saw a couple of things that you are involved in. You know, you do group therapy, you do a monthly community program called Why Diets Don't Work, and you also supervise individuals who are working towards getting their license. So tell me a bit more about the things that you do and how this integrates into the work that you're currently doing.
Yeah, so the monthly group is aspirational. I'm trying to kick that off for a while. So I'm hoping that this will be a little kick in the butt I need to get that going. It's out there now. People are going to expect it. Really where I spend a lot of my time is supervision. And I think that is critical because, like I said, we don't have enough providers. We don't have enough people that have had formal eating disorder education, training, and supervision. I got certified through IADEP, which is the International Association of Eating Disorder Professionals. And then I also did the credential to become a supervisor through them. So if anybody's doing their certification, I can provide supervision towards that. But I also provide supervision to folks who are just wanting to know more about eating disorders. And then I also, I'm starting to take practicum students from local universities to help provide them with training at the educational level too. And I think this is just so critical because we need people to know how to treat eating disorders. And my goal, somewhere in my plan for the future, I would really like to start a nonprofit that goes into educational facilities. So med schools, nursing schools, dental schools, counseling programs, because we don't get any training in eating disorders either, which is abhorrent to think about, and provide basic training on, at the very least, how to identify and refer eating disorders. Because the reality is that these folks are walking into these offices every day, and people who go into helping professions genuinely want to help, and they either don't have the information or don't know what to do. And so they're missing opportunities to say like, oh crap, like this person's struggling. We need to get them some help. You know, in my head, I hope it'll spark people to want to specialize. But at the very least, if it just sparks them to be like, oh, I need to make a referral to my eating disorder folks, that would be life-changing for so many people who struggle for years without intervention because nobody picked up that what they were doing was super unhealthy and scary. So this is why the supervision part is so, so important, because if we're training our next clinicians, then they can act as, you know, they're helping. They can be that forefront, and they can access more people, and less folks maybe have to suffer in the long run. We get to them a little earlier. They have a little bit less of a difficult road ahead of them if we have more people available for them to get help from.
I don't think there's an eating disorder professional out there that hasn't had that desire to get more education out, you know, and to help, because, you know, even I was thinking the one time I was like, it's great that I'm helping people on a one-on-one basis, even on a group basis. But, you know, there's people coming into rooms with psychologists and psychiatrists and dietitians and everything that aren't informed. And the problem is when those professionals aren't informed, perhaps a certain psychologist will be the only available resource to this person.
And they go there going like, I have an eating disorder and this is what I'm struggling with. And that person doesn't know what to do. Yes, they have some idea and they're probably very helpful in a lot of areas of that person's life. But the lack of information is definitely critical to the global healing of people that are struggling this way. And so I've also had that like, oh yeah, somewhere in the future, I'm going to have an education institute and somewhere, you know, like for research and development. And, you know, where will we get the funding for that and all of that? You know, there's all these complications. But when you speak about the lack of resources, I mean, it's even worse here in South Africa. I mean, I can probably count not even on one hand the amount of facilities that are available to people with eating disorders that aren't covered by insurance. And at the same time, sometimes aren't really going about it the right way as well in their best intention. It's been so incredible just picking your brain about these different modalities that you talk about, you know, these challenges that we're facing in the professional and personal space for eating disorders and the recovery journey. And so before we wrap up, there's just two things I'd like to ask you. The first is, do you have any words of encouragement to give to people who are struggling at the moment with eating disorders and maybe just not knowing how to take that first step?
Yeah, so recovery is so possible. You know, it's not always easy. It's not always immediate, but it's possible. And there are people who want to help. And sometimes it is difficult finding resources, but there are resources available. And there are places like IADEP, well, at least in the US, I know the resources. So there's the International Association of Eating Disorders, there's the National Eating Disorder Association, there's MEDA, which is out of Massachusetts, and I'm totally blanking on their acronym right now. Project HEAL has a lot of resources, and they scholarship, they're really wonderful. The EMILY program scholarships, and they're really wonderful. There's a lot more than there used to be. And sometimes there is a wait, but it is possible to get help. So that, I think that's the biggest thing, that it's possible to get help. And there's a ton of free resources out there. There's 12-step groups. So I don't recommend Overeaters Anonymous because it does use a food addiction model and encourages restriction. But EDA, which is Eating Disorders Anonymous, Anorexics Anonymous, Bulimia Anonymous, they're all really wonderful resources and very healthy spaces. Now, of course, if somebody finds comfort in OA and it's working for them, by all means, do what works for you. Again, I would never tell somebody to stop doing something that's creating positive in their life. There are free groups all over the US. There are free international groups. So if you can't find a therapist or a dietitian right away, there are some free resources that you can look into that can be helpful. There's stuff out there. You just might have to dig a little bit for it, but it is possible to recover.
Yeah, that's such a beautiful message. And I think it's so important for people to understand that there is a lot of space for healing if you're just willing to go and seek it, you know. A lot of online resources, a lot of community resources, and a lot of, like, there actually are sponsored resources. And you speak about the EMILY program. I'm actually interviewing the founder later this evening. So I'm like super stoked for that as well. So where can we find you, like social media, websites, anything like that? How do we get in touch if we are wanting to reach out?
Yeah. So drjoyz.com is my website. So it's drjoyzee.com. Planned this before I had a group, so it's a little weird, but we are Nourish the Heart Counseling. We're on Instagram as Nourish the Heart Counseling. We're on TikTok as Diets Don't Work One, I believe. I will admit we have not been as up on our content as we could be, but we do have some content. And then on Facebook, I think Dr. Joy Zelikowski, and probably we'll be transitioning over to a Nourish the Heart Counseling page soon as the group expands. So we're out there and we're looking to help folks who are looking for resources and help.
Well, that's really awesome. And when you do start your monthly community program called Why Diets Don't Work, you'll be letting me know and I will be sharing it on my social media so that people can get that help and support as well. So thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a really, truly a privilege.
Thank you so much for listening to today's podcast. If you have liked it, share it with people who you think might benefit from listening to it as well. Don't forget to go to my Instagram page called @curiousaboutrecovery to find out about upcoming episodes or to browse the episodes of the past. You can also follow my page called @KirstenHoneyball, where you can get inspiration for your eating disorder recovery.